Well, great to be with you this morning. Really thrilled to be able to think together with you about the things that are on our minds today and this week. My name's Rory, as Gary said, and just while I get set up, I'm going to give you an opportunity to talk to the person next to you and to tell them one thing you've left behind to be here today that's kind of regretful, something that you've left behind that you are concerned about, and then one thing you're glad that you're hoping to get out of today. So a thing that you've left behind and a thing that you're hoping to acquire. That's what you can talk to the person next to you about while I set up, and then we'll get going. All right, I'll just give you one more minute on that. Okay, anyone want to report on their neighbour? Anyone leave behind anything particularly interesting or? What are some of the things that you want to get out of today and this week, if you're here for the week? Anyone? Bueller? You just did the first one? Oh, it's all sad. What were you sad about leaving behind? Oh, okay. What did you leave behind?
Noisy children.
Okay, yes, sure, noisy children. Yes, excellent. Who else left noisy children behind? Yep, excellent. Anyone get to what they were looking forward to? Anything at all? It can be, you can make something up.
Andreas is hoping to get out some good missional thinking for walk-up evangelism.
Okay. Good missional thinking for walk-up evangelism on campuses. That's obviously where you're serving. Fantastic. Where in particular?
At UQ.
Excellent. Cool. Yeah, Jill. Great. So spiritual, intellectual, theological, coherence and insight, thinking about the world that we're inhabiting. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Easy. That'll be done by lunchtime and then we can move on to other things. Let's get one. Yeah.
A few practical tips. For me, it's like children who are growing up in a secular age totally, but I know it's adults as well. Just some practical landing places of how that could be done better differently in the way I do things.
Fantastic. So you're serving in children's ministry?
Yeah, school.
Fantastic. Okay, cool. High primary, state or Christian?
Primary and secondary Christian school, but mostly not Christian students.
Sure, great. Yeah. Yeah, categories. Yeah, that's certainly something I've wanted to get out of preparing for this, is to think, where do I park that and what's a meaningful category for that thing? How does it relate to other things? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Maybe a framework for thinking about what assumptions we can challenge about the way the church is based on our context.
Yeah, okay, so thinking about, I thought you were going to go in a different direction, so that's interesting. So you're saying you want to be able to challenge and think about some of the assumptions that we have as kind of Christian operatives about the way we're doing stuff. Thought you were going to talk about challenging the world's assumptions, but you're talking about challenging ours, which is great. Fantastic. Yeah. Mikey, I recognise you from the internet. Hi. You're internet famous. Okay, how to help people be Christian in their workplaces, and why are you nominating their workplaces?
Because of the world is changing, and I guess some of the stuff that Steve said yesterday at our church was just how the sexual revolution has changed the way we do life, I guess, and how we be Christians in the secular world.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know if this is scientifically valid or whatever. I feel like when I went into full-time Christian service, I don't know what we're supposed to call it now. We used to call it full-time ministry, but that's like not what it's called anymore. But whatever it is that lots of us have gone into, I reckon when I did and when a bunch of us did at uni, on average, we were making a slightly greater sacrifice than the average bear in doing that. And I wonder whether now it's more difficult on average in the average workplace to be faithfully Christian, and to do that well and faithfully is that's a genuinely hard thing, and that'd be a great thing to drill down into. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Yes, that's great. And so talking about the decline of like attendance or subscription to classical music, and that's a really interesting thing. We're going to be thinking about sociology a little bit today and especially tomorrow. Sorry if you've come for that today, but we'll do an overview today. And one of the advantages of sociology, which has its own inbuilt biases and so on, is that you get to think in different categories. So in sociology, churches are volunteer organisations, and you can ask what's happened to volunteer organisations since the 60s, and if you ask a question that way, it's very interesting to see what's happened to those sorts of mediating institutions, to volunteer, to those kind of older art forms and so on, and that's a very fascinating way to come at some of the questions that we've got in our heads today. All right, well, I'll let you know that. So, Rory, I've already been introduced, and I've left behind four boys. So we've got four boys who are the oldest one's nearly 14 and the youngest one's nearly 8. And so they're just going back to school after 2 weeks' holiday. They saw the Avengers, the Endgame yesterday, and they thought it was 12 out of 10. They were delirious. And I missed it. I got to be on I was on a plane while they were watching that. So I missed this key moment, perhaps the key moment in their childhood. To be with you, but that's fine. And really looking forward to being together with you guys today and together with a smaller group during the week. And very similar thoughts to you guys, wanting to come away stimulated and engaged, to have categories, to have inspiration, and to work together on the work of proclaiming Jesus in our world. So here we go. The task today and this week is to think about mission and ministry in a secular age. They're the three components: mission, ministry, the context being the secular age that we find ourselves in. I want to do this first lecture, this first session, kind of like an overture to an opera. So I want to briefly take you through some of the learning outcomes that we're going for, and to get once across the material that a small group of us will go back and go through in depth for the rest of the week. But what are we engaged in today and this week? One way to put it is to say that this whole day and this whole course is about the rise of the nuns. Not N-U-N-S, although I'm sure the nuns are doing fine, but the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, the rise of the nuns. Because one of the most extraordinary features of the Western world since the 1960s, but especially and remarkably in the last 10 years, has been the rise of the nuns, the rise of a group of people who happily and uncomplicatedly declare themselves to have no religious affiliation. That was an unheard of phenomenon in days gone by. And so one of the questions we're asking is, what made the nuns possible? Who are they? Where did they come from? What made nunness a possibility? In 2016, there were about 7 million Australians who were nuns, which is 2 million more than in 2011. That's a huge growing part of the Australian population, growing much faster than the Muslim population or the Chinese population or any other migrant population. The biggest growing group of religious affiliation are the nuns, those who have no religious affiliation. And I think the nuns, if we think about that, are part of a longer and more complex story about the fate of the gospel in the Western world. Because they're not just a group, they're not just an ethnic group, they're a symptom of a wider cause that has made their existence possible. I want to say a few things about that. Firstly, nuns not only exist and are growing, but for a large group of Australians have become the default option. To be nun, to nominate no religious affiliation, has become the default option for many. And that's just worth thinking about, that in Australia it's very rare to leave Jesus or to leave identifying with a group that identify with Jesus for Hinduism or Islam or the New Age, which is absolutely tanking. People are not leaving for that, but they're leaving for none. For no religious affiliation. And that really matters. That's just a huge and growing group, and we want to get to the bottom of how that's possible. And we want to think about the way that's become not just a position, but a taken-for-granted position, a position that is self-understood by many as one that requires no explanation. To have no religious affiliation for many is for everyone else to bear the burden of proof that the kind of default or the neutral option is none, and to have a religious commitment of any sort is to have opted in to something other than what you would naturally be if you were left to your own devices. It has the kind of nunness or a secular worldview has that kind of free pass that perhaps Christian faith once had in our culture. And because nonness has that, it often presents itself as having no story, as having no contingency, as having no background or no prehistory. It's just what is. It's just a natural reading, a natural take on the world. And I think if we're going to understand and operate in that world properly, we need to challenge precisely that point of view. Because the truth is that nonness or secularity or a secular worldview is entirely embedded in a set of contingencies, in a story, in a set of historical events and conditions that could have been otherwise. That make sense? So secularism tells itself and tells the world a story. It has myths and contingencies, and it embeds itself in that way. I think a brilliant picture of this is the 2001 census, where there was this campaign. I think we've got the thing up there. You can see there it says there was a census no religion movement, and it encouraged people to mark no religion on the 2016 census. Census, which was a completely good faith thing. They were wanting to explain to the world that you can do that, that it's not a problem to put no religion. And they were concerned that the impression of Australia's religiosity was unfairly inflated by a habit of ticking, oh, what are we, honey? I think Church of England or something. And they wanted to give a fairer impression of where we are. But notice the way the billboard works. It says, not religious anymore. You see, if the sign had just said, not religious, tick this, it would just be a sheer kind of proposition, a sheer statement of fact, but not religious anymore, turns it from a statement or an instruction to a story. See how it does that? Suddenly, you read that, and I'm not at all imputing bad faith to the people who wrote that sign, but you read that, and it's part of a story that it's dragging you into, because you read it and you think, not religious anymore. What? Is everyone not being religious? And there's a movement in our society from religious to not, and if you're not that anymore, that is, if you've kind of progressed or changed or moved, this is the box for you. It's a bit like the Trump campaign, which if the Trump campaign slogan was Make America Great, it would be boring, unremarkable, disengaging. But the moment you call it Make America Great Again, suddenly you're storytelling. And suddenly you're involving people in a before and after story. You think, wait a minute, America used to be great and now it's not great and someone's going to make it great again. And suddenly you've got a story that you can be a part of. I think it's the same dynamic here. Not religious anymore is inviting you to be part of a story. And that story is a very powerful story, a story in the West of the rise of science and of the rise of a non-religious account of the world. That means that you don't have to be religious anymore, that religion is slowly getting vacuumed up out of our society, and what we're left with is secularism. And what I want to challenge, and a big thing that Charles Taylor challenges, is the truthfulness of that story. How true is it that secularism is this taken-for-granted thing of what happens when you vacuum up religion out of a culture? I also want to say, studying the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, is going to help us to capture something of the mood of contemporary Christianity in the West. So I was scrolling through my Kindle list a little while ago, and see if you can spot the pattern in these titles. The Disappearing Church. That Was the Church That Was. Losing My Religion. How the West Really Lost God. The Benedict Option, A Strategy for Christians in a Post-Christian Society. The Death of Christian Britain. And How to Survive the Zombie Apocalypse. They're the books on my Kindle list. And what's more, with one exception, each one of those were written in the last 5 years. And so I think we could say at least this. Historians will say that our age embedded the widespread impression that Christians in the West were in trouble. Now, it's a much more complicated question to work out. Why did they feel like that? Was that true? What caused that? What went into that? But I think the thing that you can't deny from our historical perspective, we've been very close, in fact, in it, is that those book titles and the discourse and the narrative and the title of a lot of our conferences at the moment bespeak the idea that we feel, and I don't know what the right words are, afraid, under siege, in decline, under pressure. And I feel that too. To some extent, I think that that corresponds to an actual state of affairs. But one of the things we can do together is to think about that feeling and that impression critically. Because I think panic is never a good basis for decision making. To drink the Kool-Aid of panic and crisis and a siege mentality is not going to serve us well as we ask the question of how to do faithful mission and ministry in our age. And so I want us to think as clearly as we can about what's led to that impression, how true it is, and what to do about it. I think we live in days that would be great days for snake oil salesmen, because you want to generate a sense of panic so that you can move merchandise. I think we are the kind of Shelbyville people under threat of buying monorails, if you get that reference. So any questions at this point as we, I'm just going to pause there for questions as we're kind of framing what we're doing today. Reference was Simpsons, Shelbyville, the guy comes, tries to sell a monorail and it tanks, as I think all monorails do. Is there a monorail here? Was there ever one? Yeah, absolutely. There always was one once, right? And then, yeah. in Perth at the moment, they're thinking about buying someone else's monorail, which is classic, like even worse than just being the person that buys one straight away. The person that wants to buy someone else's one without asking why they don't want it anymore. Let me just talk briefly about the learning outcomes, which I won't do this too much because I realise that it's only a smaller group that are with us for the week, but it might give you a sense of where we're going. What we want to do in the course is to come away having known and understood, we'll do some of this today, Charles Taylor's influential and seminal text, A Secular Age. So in the second section after lunch, I should have said actually I'm speaking the opposite way to the way that the notes, has everyone worked that out now? I've swapped the order, so I'm speaking the 11 o'clock stuff now. Sorry if you've been trying to cram what I'm saying into the wrong set of notes. We want to understand Secular Age by Charles Taylor. We'll talk about that in the second section. We want to think about the historical and sociological debates around the process of secularisation. It's worth knowing that there's a raging debate about what causes secularisation and even whether it is true to say that we're secularising. And we want to have a critical evaluation and a theological evaluation of our responses to secularisation. I want to be able to critically engage with Charles Taylor's thought and mission and ministry, and we want to analyse theological and practical proposals for responding to contemporary Western culture with a rigorous grasp of the field and of confessional Christianity. And finally, to be in a position to understand and get our heads across some of the best contemporary mission and apologetics, and to critically evaluate some of the claims that are put before us about what the churches ought to do to respond to our situation. And the way we're going to do it, and today we'll reflect that, and we're going to follow this pattern each day, although we're going to flip to having Taylor first cab off the rank. Each day we're going to do four things, which is to do a close reading of Charles Taylor's A Secular Age, to look in depth at a particular chapter and grapple with it. Secondly, we'll have the larger and longer lecture and thinking about the theory of secularisation and the theology around secularisation and practical responses. So today we're getting across the whole terrain. Tomorrow we're going to focus on the question of secularisation from a sociological point of view. Wednesday we're thinking about theological responses to secularisation for theological movements that are self-consciously responding to the secular moment. On Thursday we're looking at discipleship and formation. How do you form people? How do you generate the kind of churches that can generate the sort of resilience that is needed to follow Jesus in our age? And then finally looking at evangelism and apologetics, thinking specifically of evangelising the nuns and more widely about evangelising a whole culture where nunness is a strong option and in many cases a default option. Then I think probably the highlight of the day will be every day in the afternoon session, Steve McAlpine, who's over there, will do a case study on a particular kind of church movement or church planting situation over the last, since the 1960s, and we'll kind of think about what that involves, the background, and critically evaluate those things. Do you want to say anything about that now, Steve? Thank you. And then the final section of each day, section four, and we'll do this today, is try to integrate what we've learned to put the stuff from Taylor together with the main lecture together with the stuff that Steve's done in the case study and try to let the sparks fly, let those things inform one another and come away with practical and God willing faithful responses to what we've been learning. Now, I'm a little bit overly excited about this, but I don't know if you noticed there's a kind of a matrix forming here, so that if you think about the days horizontally, you've got Taylor across the bottom, a series of lectures across the middle, Steve, case studies across the top, and then the integration. But then you've got these the vertical angle where on each day we're going to package together what we learnt from Taylor, what we learnt from the lecture, what we learnt from Steve into this thing. So I just wanted to acknowledge how impressed I am with how symmetrical that all is. It's kind of the mating call of bad pedagogy if you have to explain to everyone how good it is. Okay. I want to ask, is there any questions there? Otherwise, we're about to do a little exercise. So are there any questions about that kind of run across the material? All right. So here's the exercise, and I hope we don't do permanent damage to this excellent facility in the process. But what I've got here is a whole lot of post-it notes, and what I want you to do is I'm going to set up a chronological map around the room. So over at the drinking fountain will be the birth of Jesus in 4 BC, and right around to the fire hydrant will be 2019. And what I'm going to, and I'll put a few markers on the way so you can get things in order. I want to think about how we got to there. So how is it that here we are in 2019 in our particular spiritual and social circumstances? I want to know what we think the big features of that story are. So I'm thinking of events, people, publications. What are the major building blocks that get to the point where here we are thinking about a secular age? Does that exercise make sense? And so it'll be from birth of Jesus right through to 2019. So that's about halfway. So that's the year 1000. And then I'll put some little notes up there to mark into kind of 500-year increments. And I'd love you to write those down. So you can do that by yourself. And then we can put them up on the wall where they fit in history. And then we're going to talk about that together. Any confusion? Excellent. I'm going to get these out, and so you write them down. You can do two or three, and if you find one that is the one that you already thought of, just put it under that one, and then away we go. Okay. One more time. Okay, one more time. Just feel free to keep writing if you're onto it. But we're looking for, you know, a thing might say, I'll say something non-prejudicial to think. The Federation of Australia, you might think that's a massive player in the secularisation process that you couldn't possibly understand where we are, except that Australia was federated in 1901. So you'd write Federation of Australia 1901 there, or the release of Taylor Swift's Reputation album earlier this year. If you think that is the thing that has shaped our moment, then that's what you want to write down. So I'm asking for your judgment to think, if you could only, If you had to explain to someone, maybe from another country who is from a very different, but highly religious background, and they come here and they think, as someone once said to me in Thailand, when you come to Australia, you feel like you've walked into a place that just had a big fight and it feels awkward about religion. And you're trying to explain, you know, if you're in Southeast Asia, happily chat to the taxi driver about, oh, I'm Muslim, what are you? I'm Buddhist, I'm Christian. And you come to Australia and it's like, I walked into a family and they just had a big fight and I don't know what to say. So why is that? And I want your three best shots. You think the big thing is the Taylor Swift tour and the Federation of Australia and the fall of Constantinople or whatever. Yeah, be amazing if you thought that. Does that make sense? So if you're thinking about the chronology, it's vaguely but not quite proportionate. So birth of Jesus is there. That's the year 500 AD. That's the year 1000. That's the year 1500. And then I've got 1900 there. And then over on the grey door is 2019. So the events, people, places, publications that you've got... once you've got them, could you get up and put them where they fit between the birth of Jesus and 2019? Go for it. What's that? So it's going, so 0, 500, 1,000, 1,500, that's backwards? Oh, as in I should have gone that way. Sorry. Go, oh, sorry. Obviously, once yours is up, you might like to do an anti-clockwise move around the room to take in people's suggestions. Make sure you've taken that in, and just in 2 minutes, we're going to have a little a conversation about what we saw. All right. Come on back in. Make sure you've kind of had a chance to have a look around. Then we're going to notice what we noticed. All right, while you're coming back in, but feel free to just kind of keep wandering if you want to take some of it in. I'd just love to get some responses. Let's go first with the, we'll look at overall patterns, but first just any kind of outliers or things you wanted to ask, say, oh, why was that up there, or any kind of odd things you noticed, or, yeah. Fall of Constantinople, so not a massively popular one, but there it was. But does anyone want to speak into that, why where the fall of Constantinople might fit in our story? Yeah.
Well, I've got fall of Constantinople in 1204, which is when the crusade basically destroys us as a political force.
Yes.
Because, A, that means the Islamic Empire is basically controlling Eastern Europe, and B, it means a huge influx of Greek Christians and Greek philosophy and Greek manuscripts into the West.
Ah, right. Yeah. Okay, great. Excellent. Did everyone hear that? So we're talking about fall of Constantinople, but relating that to the Crusades and to the influx of Greek manuscripts and Greek learning into what Charles Taylor would call Latin Christendom. Yeah. And you're saying it's part of the story of secularization. Other ones you want to just ask questions about, or just note that they were there and you would not have thought of it yourself or something? Yeah. So someone want to speak to that? The response to the Black Death in Europe. So I noticed the wording, it's not saying the Black Death, but the response to it. Does someone want to speak into that? Yeah. Right.
And so I think there was a loss of faith in what the church was saying, which then went on to some other things at the time.
Okay. So quite specific. So you're saying the church was just compassionless or whatever, but it pulled a lever that didn't do anything.
Yeah.
And so maybe Taylor, we'll talk about Taylor in the second session, but that Taylor would talk about that as the beginning or a process of disenchantment, that an enchanted world is becoming disenchanted. So disenchantment is a world where the only minds in the world are human minds, and an enchanted world is a world where magic is possible, and there's demons and fairies, and there are things in the world that have agency and will, and there are things in, like people would steal the host. You know this? The reason in lots of Catholic practice, I'm not sure if it's still Vatican II thing, but you would open your mouth to receive the host rather than receive receive the bread not in your hand but straight into your mouth. Anyone know why that was? It's because people would steal the host, put it on their mouth but not swallow it, and then go and plow it into the fields or give it to a sick pig or whatever, which was completely coherent way of thinking, because you think, this has got power in it and I want that power to go to that one. So is this the kind of point? Right, yes. So if one pig doesn't get healed by one host, that's all right. But if it's this plenary disaster. Okay, fantastic. Other ones?
I think the very first one over there, like the start of the early church, so Jesus passing on to the disciples to the early church.
Yeah. As in, so someone's put up there, the basically second generation screwed it up. Or Yeah, does anyone want to speak to that? So what are they over there? I'm going to read them.
If you don't fess up, we'll work out your handwriting. death and resurrection of Jesus, and then the ministry, like a line from Jesus to the 12 to the early leaders.
You don't have to fess up if that was yours, but does anyone want to speak to it? Okay. It is yes.
It's injecting other systems into the grace relationship.
Right. Okay. That might be what we're thinking about here, that there's some systematizing of Jesus as a charismatic, prophetic first century teacher, band of 12, doesn't write books or set up systems or whatever, and maybe there's something goes on in that second and third generation. One of the things we'll discover over the week, and hopefully even today, is that one of the self-critical and critical lines of thinking we can apply to this is that you notice almost anyone who's speaking about that has an original sin theory that is somewhere in here. So, not saying it's right or wrong, but it will almost always reflect what you think ought to happen here. So if you're... in a particular, like I think certainly in free church, American South or whatever, often Darwin's Origin of Species is the big thing. And so you put a lot of effort into thinking against or out of evolutionary theory. If you're, say, N.T. Wright, it's all about the Enlightenment. So that's where it gets messed up. If you're often people who are in missional community, or in Anabaptist traditions, we'll think the mistake is really Constantine or even post-New Testament organisational structures. Or if you're like John Milbank or the Radical Orthodox movement or James K. Smith, you want voluntarism and you'll see William of Ockham and Dunce Scotus as the guys that mess it up. But Pope Benedict would thinks in those categories as well. And it's worth just thinking that if all you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And it's worth thinking, why do I think that's the thing? May or may not be right, but how is it shaping our contemporary ministry practice? It's often shaped by what you think the problem was and how that went through. My alarm just told me that it's nearly time for morning tea. Do you want to just do a little macro sense? Was anyone surprised, delighted, disturbed by the, not the micro, but like the pattern that emerged? Yeah.
I was just wondering if some people were putting out speakers not about the right things that led to secularism, but just major historical events.
Right, okay.
So Jesus' death and resurrection, I didn't quite understand how that led to secularism.
Yes.
Directly.
Yeah, okay.
I could make up an argument for it.
Yeah. It might, you know, maybe that would be Pilate's take, that's the great victory of, although the secular is, we're going to come to the meaning of the word secular, and we've purposely done it the wrong way around, and we're trying to think about these things before we've defined our terms, so we have a better thing.
I'm struck by how dark the Dark Ages are.
Yeah, so no one, and what do you take from that?
Well, it's like they're opaque, and that's why we call them dark, but there must have been things happening in that period that produced that.
Yes, yeah. Now, and what there is, probably we're slightly disproportionate in that William of Ockham and voluntarism and nominalism should all be in the Dark Ages, so it's slightly thing. But I think that probably for evangelical education, that is a big Dark Age. Whereas if you read David Bentley Hart or someone in the Orthodox tradition, that's where they get everything right. And you can, you know, David Bentley Hart writes a book that's purportedly the history of Christianity, and it's all done by about, the Seventh Council, and there's not much more to say. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And even with it, you know, if you're from Northern Ireland and you were Catholic, you're more likely to have kept your faith in the USA. If you're Protestant, you're more likely to have lost it. It's a rich story. So we're going to have a break for morning tea, and then we're going to come back and think about some of this stuff and plug it back into wider secularisation theory and into Charles Taylor. Thanks for your attention so far. Back here by 11, and you've got to self-regulate, so make sure you are back here by 11.